Good evening, this is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720 and to a festive evening. We're going to review the works and ways, the career and the pleasures of Abe Burrows tonight. And that means that we'll play a lot of good music from Guys and Dolls, from Can-Can, Silk Stockings, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. And of course, we're going to begin someplace early on in our conversation with a quick interpolation of the greatest love song ever written, The Girl with the Three Blue Eyes. Abe Burrows, playwright, producer, musical playwright or librettist, author, play doctor, a man of the theater, of the films, and of radio, where he got his start. And we'll talk about the old days
in
radio. And a
Notary Public. You forgot Notary Public.
And a Notary Public, and occasionally a man who tried to sell stock, and also woven tags, whatever they are. We'll make all of that abundantly clear right after the usual update on the evening's news.
I got the horse right here, the name is Paul Revere, and here's a guy that says if the weather's clear, can do, this guy says the horse can do, if he says the horse can do, can do. I picked him Valentine, 'cause on the morning line, the guy has got him figured at 5 to 9.
But if he left the task, he went to buy a hat, according to this here and that telegraph.
But Paul Revere, I'll fight, I hear his sports all right, of course it all depends if it rained last night.
I know it's Valentine, 'cause on the morning line, the guy has got him figured at 5 to 9.
But just a minute, boys, they got some people. Noise as like the great grandfather was equipoise.
I tell you, Paul Revere, now this is no bum steer. It's from a handicap, but that's real sincere.
I know it's Valentine.
Fugue for Tin Horns from Guys and Dolls by Lesser and Burroughs. Abe Burrows, was that the first time in your life that you committed a fugue?
Yeah. It was my first show. I had done a lot of things, but Guys and Dolls was my first show. And I remember, as if you heard that horn that goes, you know, the first call.
That's the first race to Jamaica.
When the guys, three guys walked, I was sat in Philadelphia, nervous, my first show. And three guys walk on stage carrying racing forms, and the orchestra, the trumpet player, played that first call. And there was a huge laugh of recognition. I said to my wife, I kissed my wife on the cheek and said, we're home. I knew it right away because they bought the idea just from that horn.
It's a wonderful show.
And Frank was a genius.
Well, that's in the middle of your career, but your career begins, I discovered, back on my home turf. As you know, because I've made it clear to you, and I discovered this about you reading your wonderful new autobiography, Honest Abe, by Abe Burrows. I discovered that you were not born in Bensonhurst, but in your youth you came to live in Bensonhurst.
That's right.
Or as we properly pronounce it, Bensonhurst.
Bensonhurst,
back in Brooklyn.
That's right.
And now comes the second tune of the evening. This is my surprise for you. I also discovered you and I went to the same high school. You were there some number of years before me, but do you remember the school anthem?
Hearts and hands together, boys, together, boys.
That's the fight song. But
you're 10,000 boys, 10,000 girls,
united in these high school halls.
Halls don't rhyme with girls. You
it's
know
all right.
That.
To share in studies and in joys, await the day when service calls. Come on now. With heart and voice and golden tongue, loud be the name of Utrecht sung. Together all, a song of cheer. You got to come in on the last line, the soccer finish. For alma mater greeted here.
Oh, yeah. I cried.
It's one of the great schools of the world. Nobody out in the Midwest knows about New Utrecht.
New Utrecht, no.
Tell them about New Utrecht.
Well, Michael Kidd, who did the choreography for Guys and Dolls and for Can-Can, another show I did with Cole Porter. And Buddy.
Buddy Hackett, whose real name is Lenny Hacker, and he and I played in the high school band, directed by Mr. Harry Cherry. And not Harry Carey, but Harry Carey.
And Robert Merrill, the opera singer.
Right.
And Martha Stewart, who was in Guys and Dolls. And many, many, many people.
And many famous scholars as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Who went from there to City College or Brooklyn College, and from one of those places on to graduate school elsewhere, and are now distinguished scientists, philosophers, statesmen. And well, I can't really think of any statesmen at the moment who came from the United
States. Well, I can't think of any statesmen at all in any high school. From any high school, I can't.
Richard Hotlett, who covers the UN for CBS News.
New Utrecht?
Is a graduate of New Utrecht High School.
Really?
Yep.
That got me. I didn't know that.
In the first years of the war, when I was still in high school, Hotlett was a reporter for AP or UP in Berlin and was held as a hostage in Berlin for a while until they negotiated his release.
It was a marvelous school.
Well, you're a New Yorker born and bred and pure.
I followed the regular thing. Born in the Lower East Side, moved to the Bronx, then to Bensonhurst, where I kind of really grew up.
And you never really left New York. You, of course,
did your stint in
Hollywood.
Yeah, I was in Hollywood for about 12 years.
I discover also from this wonderful book, let me give the title again, Honest Abe.
Well, there's a comma there after honest. It's a little, see, it isn't Honest Abe like Lincoln.
It's Honest Abe.
That's right. You see, it came about when I won the Pulitzer Prize for how to succeed in business without really trying. And I was taking a nap. And you usually hear about the Pulitzer Prize from somebody of the press. And I'm taking a nap, and my secretary says, I think you'll want to hear this. And I get on the phone, and it's a reporter. And he says, hey, this is Associated Press. He says, I want to tell you that you won the Pulitzer Prize for how to succeed. And I was drowsy, and I had always thought when a moment like that I would say some great words like, England expects every man to do his duty, something like that, you know? Instead, I said, no kidding. I really did. And he said, Honest Abe. And my editor picked that up as the title.
The subtitle is there really no business like show business? That's the answer to that question?
I don't know. It's a thing and I'm very tired during rehearsal. And every day, sometimes I say to the cast, is there really no business like show business? Matter of fact, I did a little song, which is not a complete song, just a few lines, but it's about show business. I say, I borrowed this from Irving Berlin, really. Yesterday they told you you would not go far. Last night you opened and they were right.
You've got a number of unfinished songs. It's rather like Schubert's Unfinished Symphony.
Yeah, titles.
Titles. What were some of those others?
If you were the only girl in the world and I were the only boy, okay, but right now let me alone. I have very bitter love songs.
What was it they used to call you in that phase of your career? The song buster.
Song buster,
yeah. And the idea was essentially to satirize.
Well, yeah,
show
I satirized. And most of my friends, Frank Lesser was very close to me, most of my friends were songwriters. So I used to make fun of the of their songs, the kind of songs. You know, when I said the girl with the three blue eyes, it was a special, you know. You're going to play that?
We're getting set up to play the girl with the three blue eyes, but talk about it some more.
Yeah,
I'm just getting people ready.
And my girl is better than your girl type song. You know, I always called them type song. I had various kind of type songs, romantic type songs, political type songs, all kind of stuff like that. And this was a My Girl is Better Than Your Girl type song. And it's kind of nice.
And she's got a certain uniqueness about
That's
her.
That's right. Special.
And this one really had a very unique quality, a very unique feature.
Right.
And here she is.
Here's another type song. It's a love song. My Girl is a special type of girl type song. Thus.
Walked along singing, no time for blues or sad. Cause by heaven above, I'm in love with the girl with the three blue eyes. You can't upset me, no none of you's gloomy guys. Cause by heaven above, I'm in love with the girl with the three blue eyes. What makes her different? Is it the way she walks? All the way she shakes her pert little skirt, all the way she talks. That's why I'm singing nothing but blue sky. Cupid gave me a shower, and I am in love with the girl with the three blue, girl with the three blue, not one
not two, but three. Do I?
I love it. It's as great now as it was. When did you record that?
Oh, that particular recording was back in 1944 or something. Jack Capp talked me into that record thing. It was before I became performing in nightclubs and stuff like that, because my voice didn't get better, but my
This is when you were still in your parties.
That's right,
phase,
just parties.
Doing the stuff at parties.
Yeah, I used to do it to tease my friends. That's all. I had all kinds of Tokyo Rose, things like that.
Ain't you sorry now, Tokyo Rose? Sorry.
I'll bet you're sorry now, Tokyo Rose. Sorry for what you done. And that was when they captured Tokyo Rose.
Yeah, do you remember the rest of it?
Yeah. I'll bet you're sorry that you went to work for that old rising sun. You stuck a knife into the USA. You forgot what they learned you at UCLA. I'll bet you're sorry now, Tokyo Rose. Sorry for what you... Then I play... Sorry for what you done. That's no accompaniment. I like that.
How would it affect you if I told you that it's quite possible that the real Tokyo Rose, about whom you wrote that song, is listening to you tonight on the radio?
Good.
She lives in Chicago, you know.
Yeah, well, I didn't say bad things about her.
No.
I bet you're sorry, and I agree.
But she lives right here in town, and
really?
She has a little curio shop in town.
Well, I didn't attack her or anything. I just, when they captured her and stuff, I thought it was nice to do a song about it.
Each of those songs of that period is a sort of an assault, a loving but satirical assault on some standard form in popular music.
Yeah.
Now, another one, and we've got it right here, is you put a piece of carbon paper under your heart and...
Don't give me a punchline. You're going to play
Should
it?
Should I stop right there?
Yeah.
We're going to play it. What do you want to say about it before we play it?
It's a secretary-type song, I think.
Secretary-type song.
Yes, I don't know.
Here it is.
This next song is the kind that's known as a clever type love song. Get this.
You put the piece of carbon paper under your heart and gave me just a copy of your love. Each dove and pigeon'll know who got the original. Darling, can't you see what you mean to me? Oh, how you fooled me with those giggles, winks, and nudges. The love that you gave me was a duplicate with smudges. 'Cause you put the piece of carbon paper under your heart and gave me just a copy of, gave me just a copy of, gave me just a second sheet of love. It might be better to call that one a stationary type song.
That's right.
You were saying?
I thought I should have been a cantor.
Did you ever try it? Some of your best friends.
That beautiful high notes there.
You've got a wonderful story in the book, Honest, Abe, in which you have your first meeting with Al Jolson. He wasn't a cantor, but he plays a cantor's son in the original Jazz Singer.
Yeah.
And then somehow that's reproduced in the film about Jolson himself, that where Larry Parks plays Jolson, but Jolson sings Jolson.
Yeah.
There's a cantorial myth around Jolson.
Yeah.
He didn't behave much like a cantor when you met him.
Well,
it
was funny. He was this a great ego. And first time I met him, I was at my agent's office because I got a sponsor for my first A. Burroughs show, which is a good title for a show. You got to admit that. And
I'm planning to retitle this show, The Abe Burroughs Show, after you leave.
And I got a sponsor, and I'm in my agent's office, Abe Lastfogle, the William Morris Agency, and he's congratulating me. And Al Jolson walked in. He was the same age. He had the same agent. And Jolson walked right in, you know, not announced. And Lastfogle said to him, Al, I want you to meet Abe Burroughs. He just got his first sponsor on his radio show. And I looked at me, and he reached in his pocket, didn't say anything, reached in his pocket, pulled out a clipping, and said, hey, kid, see what the New York Times just said about me. You know? And that was it. He didn't say hello, or how do you do, or anything. But it was a funny thing. Jolson could do that all over the place, that kind of ego, you call it. But at the same time, he was not a phony. You see, he was great. a great performer.
He was authentically narcissistic was authentic, rather than a phony.
Yeah, there are a lot of egotists who are bums, you know. Yeah. Bum egotist, a nice title. Anyway, he was great, and so nobody could ever stay mad at Jolson or anything or be angry with him.
Have you ever been mad at anybody in your life for a long time? You don't strike me as the sort of guy who maintains enmities.
Well, I tell you, Jack Kahn, E.J. Kahn did a profile on me in the New Yorker once, and he called the title, he went on the road with me with a show and everything, he called the title The Easygoing Way. He said to me once, right, hey, what do you do with your anger? You know, I said, I don't waste it. I don't blow. There's no point in it. But when I decided I had to be angry, it was very effective. People used to get very upset.
That was just faking it when you were a director,
really,
right?
Because I don't get real. You don't get... Anger is such a waste. Real anger is painful, and it's such a waste of you and the people you're angry, but you can't stop it. I get angry. I've gotten angry. I'm not a sweetheart, but I don't carry grudges, and I understand the people. In the theater, you got to understand them.
So you're not going to get angry at me if I tell you at this very moment that we've got to stop for some commercials.
Well, that makes me very angry. That's terrible.
We better get off the air and
all right.
The commercials.
All right, God, if you want to do that, okay.
Thank you very much, Carl Grayson. As I was reminding Carl Grayson when I introduced Abe Burrows and Carl Grayson, we did a program, Abe, about a year ago in which we dealt with great speeches. And we had a professor of rhetoric from Northwestern who knows a lot about the history of oratory. And we started with Demosthenes and came on down, I guess, to JFK. But for the first three, Demosthenes, Cicero, and Patrick Henry, we couldn't get any recordings of their speeches, and so we had Carl Grayson read them. And his Cicero speech was the great Against Catiline speech, and that connects back to you, because you tell a wonderful story about something that happened to you at New Utrecht High School in your Latin class, involving that very speech.
Yeah, it was the third year of Latin, and you studied Cicero's speeches and everything, and I did a translation of his famous speech about how long, Catiline, shall we put up with your silly business, whatever.
How dare you show your face in the Senate?
Quos usquam Catilina, quotis usquam Catilina, te abutere nostra patien, how long will you abuse our patience? And I translated the whole thing, and my teacher said to me, I'm going to flunk you on this. I'm going to give you an F on this piece. I said, why? She says, you're using a trot. Now, a trot is what is called a pony, and it's in schools, guys buy, it's sort of a bootleg, like bootleg booze. There are translations that you can buy, and a lot of guys used to, instead of translating, they used to copy the trot. And I was shocked, and I was so shocked that she believed me, and she pulled back. I don't know, you know, she didn't kiss me or anything, but she was a nice lady who wore a watch on her waist, you know, the old school. But she had me then go to other schools, and I used to talk to the second year Latin scholars to go on to Cicero. And I became a sort of a spokesman for that. And when I went to college, I made a little money tutoring high school kids in Latin. I used to get $1 an hour. Couldn't get more.
With just a little different tilt on the wheel of fate, you might have wound up a Latinist.
I would like
with a PhD and teaching in classics in some American
really
university today.
I really would have. And in my fourth year of Latin, was 7 girls and me in the class, and there was a scholarship coming up and graduation. Cornell offered a scholarship of 4 years, everything free, everything, sleeping place and everything, and except you had to say you'd major in Latin or Greek. And I thought I might have a shot at it, but a girl got it, another nice girl, very bright. Almost as bright as I was, very hard to be. And so I didn't make that, and maybe today I would have been a Latin teacher, and I wouldn't have been unhappy.
And you would cast the haruspices for your fellow faculty members. Can you tell me what haruspices really are?
Haruspices.
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 it's some kind of omen. I think it's the reading of chicken gizzards or something of the sort.
Arispites.
It was much practiced in Rome as a way of forecasting the future.
Giblets.
Yeah, reading the giblets.
Reading the giblets, certainly.
How do we segue
from
that?
You make soup out of Gerispites.
How do we segue from that to your career in radio? By first announcing the name of a great radio station. This is WGN, Clear Channel Radio from Chicago. How did you break into radio?
I was broke. I mean, I wasn't the guy who said, I want to be a writer, I want to be this, I want to be that. I was just trying to find a job. I was on Wall Street for a while, then the crash came.
You joined in the right year, 1929, you went to work on Wall Street.
Oh, yeah, and then I became an accountant for a while. I sold woven labels and stuff like that. And then finally I met a fella who had a typewriter and who knew where to go with the stuff. And we started selling jokes. We sold jokes to guys like Henny Youngman, you know, Panhandle.
Do you remember
jokes.
That first joke that you sold to Henny Youngman?
I think it was, he says, that was in the old days of the Depression, Panhandler jokes they were. And I had one for him. A panhandler came up to me and said, will you give me 10 cents for a cup of coffee? And I said, coffee's only a nickel. He said, won't you join me?
Like that. That's still quite funny.
I even did the reverse. I did less than a nickel. Usually it was more.
The 4 cents joke. Yeah. What? The panhandler comes up and says, give me 4 cents for a cup of coffee.
4 cents for a cup of coffee. I said, coffee's only a nickel. Is a nickel. He says, who buys retail? Things like that.
So you started selling jokes to young men and people like that.
Yeah.
But pretty soon you wound up writing whole programs.
What happened was we were writing some jokes for a great mimic named Eddie Garr, who's died since. And we introduced us to Ed Gardner. He was going to be a guest on it. And Ed Gardner met my partner and myself. His name was Frank Galen. He's not alive anymore. And he hired us for $25 a piece. He says, I can use you guys. We were talking, $25 a piece. And we said, hooray, you know, a job. And then they were working at something, and I came up with some kind of a line. I never forget it. I never remember it now. Something I said. He looked at me, he liked it. He says, give you $30. And $30 next week was $75. And then he took us to, we went to California to do the Texaco Star Theater with Ken Murray. And from then on, things rolled.
And
then Duffy's Tavern.
Duffy's Tavern began in 1941.
I think that was a classic.
Wonderful program. You still remember the opening line that he did every night in which you wrote?
Hello, this is Duffy's Tavern, where the elite meet to eat. Archie, the manager, speaking. Duffy ain't here. Oh, hello, Duffy.
That's it. Shirley Booth was Miss Duffy. And guest artists just about on every
program. Everybody, yeah. Everybody.
So that's when you first began to meet the elite of show business.
Yep. And everybody came on the show. I mean, Charles Laughton, guys like that, you know, Cary Grant, they all wanted to be on it. And by then I was friends with Frank and my songwriting friends. I began to know more and more and began to write my songs, and it went on and on. And then I wrote for, I worked in Paramount for a very short time.
The man that hired you was fired the day you arrived to start
Absolutely.
Your new job.
I worked there. I was going to be a writer-producer at Paramount, at Paramount, and Ed had given me this ring to send me off with good luck wishes, and I walked into Paramount. I'm now a writer-producer, and I go in to see the fellow who hired me, Joe Sistrom, who was head of the studio, head of production of the studio. And I walked in, and there he is, pulling down the pictures off his wall, emptying his desk, all that stuff. And I said, hey, Joe, what's going on? He says, I'm leaving. I'm out. I said, well, who do I talk to if I'm in trouble? He says, nobody. You're really in trouble. I was lasted 13 weeks.
Which was the term of the initial contract,
That's
I
right.
suppose. It, somehow a line of Shakespeare comes to mind. Do you like lines of Shakespeare?
There's certainly lines.
Summer's lease, half all too short a date. Is that Shakespeare? Maybe somebody else, for all I know.
No, it could be Shakespeare.
But it was a pretty brief stay. But, of course, you had some other Hollywood chores that you picked up on.
Well, I mean, I went back to work. I wrote Dinah Shore's show, then Joan Davis' show, and finally I got my own show.
The A. Burroughs Show.
The A. Burroughs Show. I like that title.
We've got one piece left that I want to play before we get on to the musicals, but this again from the A. Burroughs song satirist period. And by the way, I do want to say that we've had these, the first two we heard and the one we're going to hear now, through the good offices and courtesy of WFMT, another and fine radio station here in town, and Lois Baum, who works for them and got this out of her library for us and made some copies, so here we are. Now, tell me about Run, 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 Run spelled R-O-N.
You're saying it wrong. Run, 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 petit pata pata pum. This is what I used to call a Jean Zablon type song.
I remember Jean Zablon. He was one of those fake Frenchmen on...
No, he was a nice fellow. He was not fake. He was
really a real Frenchman?
Oh, yeah.
He sounded too French to be really French.
No, he really was a Frenchman.
Yeah.
And yeah, you can't fake being a Frenchman all the time. No, he was very good, but I just sang my version of it.
This is the chanteur or something of the sort.
Chanteur.
Yeah.
Chanteur.
Let's hear A. Burroughs as Jean Sablon or one of those boys.
Yeah.
Here's a French type song. The sort of thing a fellow in a battered felt hat with a green spotlight on him sings in a small, intimate bistro. Sur le pont de l'Avignon. Je ne sais pas, je ne sais. Quelque chose, quelque chose. Je vous aime. On y soit qui m'y pense. Une poêle de carole. Une carne de bal. Je vous aime. Run, run, run. Pide, pata, pata, pon. Je vous aime. Run. Run, run, patty, pitty, putty, pom, je vous aime. La, 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 ouvrez ta fenêtre, ce soir, mamma mia. Run, 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 pitty, patta, patta, pom, run. Ron, ah, que vous êtes belle.
That is wonderful. It starts with Sur le pont d'Avignon. Every one of those phrases is from someplace else.
Yeah, all the time.
You know what that somehow reminded me of as we were listening? Do you remember Max Schulman? You probably know Max
Schulman.
Sure,
I know Max.
And that wonderful comic and satiric novel of his, Barefoot Boy with Cheek, which came out, I guess, in about the same period we're talking about, the mid-1940s. He starts each chapter with a French epigraph, a fake epigraph, all of them ascribed to classic French authors, so that he has I think his second chapter opens with the following, assigned to Voltaire. Tous les hommes qui habitent cet hôtel sont fous. All the people in this hotel are crazy. Voltaire.
Oh, that's
and La plume de ma tante est sur la table, Racine, and so on. want to get into some of the music from the great musicals that you did. This is jumping ahead in your career. We're going to jump forward, jump backward, and talk about all sorts of things. We opened tonight with the Fugue for Tin Horns, or I've Got the Horse Right Here, which is the very beginning of Guys and Dolls.
Really a great piece of music.
Jeez. It's a great show. I think it's... there are those who write about the history of the American musical theater who see that particular show, Guys and Dolls, as a transformation and at the beginning of a whole new period in American musicals. Somehow an accommodation to the structure, though not necessarily the high style, of opera. I once read a piece by a musicologist who argues that... who analyzes a number of... The separate songs, and indeed with regard to Fugue for Tin Horns, he analyzes it as a fugue and says that Lesser was doing a good deal of adaptation of ideas which you find clearly developed in Verdi and other such operatic composers.
Opera, the word opera is the plural of opus.
Of work.
And the works.
A work.
And he did the fugue, he did waltzes, he did marches, he did everything. And I think together what we did was the other new thing about it. The other new thing about it was that it was, I think, the first funny, really funny story, a funny thing, a funny play of its kind. Because usually in the musicals, the comedy used to be comedy relief. a couple came on, they said funny things, and then they disappeared. And the rest was romance, all the things. All those shows were romantic. Showboat, which was a great musical, was a romantic thing. We did a comedy, and a comedy going together, and Frank wrote comic songs to match it. And it's playing all over us to this day, you know.
I want to play one other cut from the original cast recording. And I wonder how many of our younger listeners will be surprised when I tell them that the following is sung by Alan Alda's father.
Yeah.
This is Robert Alda, who played in the original the role of Sky Masterson, right?
Yeah, Alan was a kid, and he used to come around, and he was about 12 years old, I think, and he used to tell me, think of jokes, you know?
Did he really?
And I was very polite. He was a nice kid. He was a lovely kid.
Well, here's his father, Robert Alda, singing Luck Be a Lady.
Oh, yeah.
They call you Lady Luck, but there is room for doubt. At times you have a very unladylike way of running out. You're on a date with me. The pickings have been lush. And yet before this evening is over, you might give me the brush. You might forget your manners. You might refuse to stay. And so the best that I can do is pray. Luck be a lady tonight. Luck be a lady tonight. Luck, if you've ever been a lady to begin with, luck be a lady tonight. Luck, let a gentleman see how nice a dame you can be. I know the way you treated other guys you've been with. Luck, be a lady with me. A lady doesn't leave her escort. It isn't fair, it isn't nice. A lady doesn't wander all over the room and blow on some other guy's dice. So let's keep the party polite. Never get out of my sight. Stick with me, baby, I'm the fella you came in with. Luck be a lady. Luck be a lady. Luck be a lady tonight.
Luck be a lady tonight. Luck be a lady tonight. Luck, if you've ever been a lady to begin with, luck be a lady tonight.
Luck, let a gentleman see how nice a dame you can be. I know the way you've treated other guys you've been with. Luck be a lady. A lady wouldn't flirt with strangers. She'd have a heart. She'd have a soul. A lady wouldn't make little snake eyes at me. I've bet my life on this roll. So let's keep the party polite.
Let's keep the party polite.
Never get out of my sight.
Never get out of my sight.
Stick with me, baby. I'm the fella you came in with. Luck be a lady.
Luck be a lady.
Luck be a lady.
Luck be a lady.
Luck be a
lady.
You know, Abe, I was just remembering, I saw that on Broadway, I think within the first month, and I don't know exactly what I paid, but it was a heavy fee because I had to buy it from one of those ticket agencies. I was back from graduate school visiting my parents in New York and took a girlfriend to see that, and a heavy date and an expensive one. I think we dined at the Champlain, what was then a good but supposedly cheap French restaurant on 49th Street, not far from the theater.
Yeah.
But you were just saying, while we were listening, that front row center would have cost $6.60 in those days.
$6.60. Today, a hit show like that would be $25, $27.50. It's incredible, quite different. But, of course, the show in those days cost about, I think it was about $350,000 to put on, guys and dolls.
Mm. What would it cost today?
Today would cost $1.5 million. Something like
for openers.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, yeah.
We got to pause, take care of some overdue commercials, then back to the musical theater as organized, reformed, and revitalized by Abe Burrows and his friends. Right back after this. Back to the musical theater. Who were the guys you were mixing it up with in those days? Frank Lesser, of course. Kaufman directed Guys and Dolls. Yep. Who were a few of the other principals in that circle that really remade American musical comedy?
Well, George Abbott was good, a great musical director. Josh Logan, South Pacific, you know, and I saw South Pacific. That was incredible. That was a remarkable show. And then... The other thing is Carousel that they wrote. I always told, they're gone now, Oscar and Dick. But I love Carousel probably more than any of their shows. And they agreed with me. I was once standing on with a New York reporter, Jack O'Brien. And he stands there, and he has that last scene in Carousel, and he stands there crying. He always did. And Oscar Hammerstein came up behind us and he said, Jack, he said, if you ever stop crying, don't come see it. You know, we used to drop in. One great thing about having a show on Broadway, you could walk around, you saw your own show, and you drop in on the other one, find the high spots. Mm. But that was a whole big, Showboat was one of the big things that touched off really a great kind of musical. Was really.
You mean that was really the beginning of American musical theater rather than ticky-tack? Musical comedy.
Showboat was pretty great. That was Jerome Kern and Oscar Hammerstein, too. And incidentally, this song was Along Came Bill, you know, that famous one. Wodehouse wrote those lyrics. B.G. Wodehouse.
B.G. Wodehouse?
Yep. And Oscar allowed it to be interpolated.
I never knew that.
Yeah. Amazing man.
Can you did with Cole Porter, is that right?
Yep. I did two shows with Cole Porter.
The other
Can-Can
was
Silk Stockings.
Silk Stockings.
Incidentally, I'm reviving Can-Can this fall.
Yes, I heard.
Yeah?
Yeah.
With
that's exciting.
Roland Petit is coming over from France to do a choreography. I'm going to let him do what he wants to with it.
He's the man who runs Ballet de Paris.
Yeah. And his wife is Zizi Jeanmaire.
Yes.
And she's going to be the star. Now, I have to do some rewriting because the original lead was a singer, just a singer and didn't dance. And Gwen Verdon stole the show. And now I'm going to fix things for Gigi is going to be the lead, and she's marvelous.
From Can-Can, I want to play I Love Paris. Now, was this version of a Jean Sablon Petit Patit song?
No, this is for real.
This is real,
this
French.
Cole loved Paris. He really did, and the song is I Love Paris.
Every time I look down on the timeless town where the blue of the Arabian skies, where the loud be her tears, or where the soft be her tears, more and more do I realize I love Paris in the springtime. I love Paris in the fall. I love Paris in the winter when it drizzles. I love Paris in the summer when it sizzles. I love Paris every drizzles. I love Paris in the summer when it sizzles. I love Paris every moment of the year.
I loved that show. And, you know, I got my first time in Paris, because I went over to really do some research, because Can-Can is based on some real things I found out. You know, I went to the courts. I went up and down Montmartre, up the hills. And I learned a lot about it. It was, you know, girls used to get, it was censored. The girls were arrested, Can-Can, and there was a guy, Papa La Pedure, Papa Procureur. No, this was Papa Rectitude or something, you know. Pedure. And he was a congressman, and he had passing laws against the Can-Can and everything. I found a lot of stuff, and I was in the courts. It was my first time in Paris alone. I'd never been there, and I was by myself. My wife wasn't with me, and I stayed in the hotel, the George V, which is the Americans and Englishmen all stay there, George V. As a matter of fact, the operators of the hotel used to say, George V, you know? But I had my high school French, and I remember one morning I got up, and I didn't find my shoes. I was wearing brogues, and I asked the chambermaid, the femme de chambre, my shoe, où est... I didn't know that the ballet used to take it to shine. I said, où est mes sabots?
That would be wooden shoes,
wooden shoes, yeah. And she looked at me, and I couldn't think of the word of soulier, the shoes. I said, où est sabot? Well, she laughed hysterically, and I got to be known as the wit of that hotel. They thought I was really kidding them, because they all made fun of American shoes. Big brogues, you know? Frenchmen didn't wear those kind of shoes.
Speaking of the chambermaid or somebody else, say the valet service in a French hotel, Georges V or otherwise, do you know how you would ask them the following question? Are the gloves of the Archduchess, are they dry, completely dry?
You say it.
It's a wonderful French tongue twister.
Let me hear.
Les chaussettes de l'archiduchesse sont-elles sèches, archi-sèches? How about that?
Nice.
I worked on that for about a year I committed it to memory.
But gradually I was there, I began to, my high school French began to pick up, but I had to learn things. For instance, I was with Lilo, the lady who was in Can-Can, the star, and I was with her, and kids were asking for her autograph, and since I was with her, they asked me for my autograph. And I said, Lilo, donnez moi un plume. And she laughed hysterically. She says, hey, a plume is a feather. When we were kids, the plume de ma tante, you know.
Where's the pen? What's the pen?
The word is, for pen is stylo, a fountain pen. I learned things like that. Otherwise, I had a great time.
Abe, interpolate something for me.
Yes, sir.
As I read this book of yours, which I love, I think it's wonderfully done, there's a fine, easy style. It's light, it's very funny in many places, and at the same time a very authentic and significant gentleman comes through, and a man of considerable talent. It's not puffed up. It isn't, you don't take yourself terribly seriously, but you reflect on a life that seems to me to have been in the main a fulfilling life. One thing that stands out a great deal, and this is what I want to lead you towards now, you seem to have considerable capacity for loving people and making good friendships. Let's talk about some of the people who really mattered to you in your life. Who were they?
Well, we talked about George Kaufman and Cole Porter, and then I worked with Furen Martin. Now, Cy Furen went to New Utrecht, too.
Yes, I discovered that from your book.
Yeah, we forgot him. He and his partner was Ernie Martin, who were with me. They talked me into doing Guys and Dolls. And I seem to see a whole bunch of friendships. Lauren Bacall I had in Cactus Flower. She and I were friends. Julie Harris I did 40 Carats with. There's a sensational lady. Just a sensational lady. A great actress of the kind. She's small. Like remind me of Helen Hayes. That is, she can rattle the timbers, you know? Big voice when she wanted to. A great actress.
Who were your closest buddies through the years?
Well, Frank Lesser was my closest. Cy Furen is a close friend. And people like that. A lot of them are gone now.
You still mourn Lesser's death, don't
very
you?
Much.
10 years ago, but...
Very much. I wrote an obituary for him. Somebody sent it to me recently, and sure, I looked at it again. See, I remember the kind of guy he was. There's one thing. When I went to see Most Happy Fellow, which he wrote by himself, I went out of town. And great songs, Big D, Big Dallas song, and standing on the corner while watching all the girls go by.
And I'm at the Most Happy Fellow.
I'm at the Most Happy Fellow. But I came backstage to see him. I said, Frankie, I had such a good time. And that Big D, that Dallas, was so wonderful. And standing on the corner, he said to me, ah, shut up. He says, you know that I can write that kind of stuff, but where did I make you cry?
Mm-hmm.
And he made me cry when he died.
Yeah. Who was that Metropolitan Opera star who appeared originally in The Most Happy Fellow? Robert...
Oh, yeah, Robert Weedy.
Robert Weedy.
And Frank's...
Wonderful performer.
Frank's widow was Jo Sullivan. She was the girl.
Hmm.
I think he fell in love with her while she was doing that show.
I want to get on to one more selection that we've got. From Silk Stockings, the song Silk Stockings, sung by original cast.
Yeah.
Sung by Don Ameche.
Yeah.
Imagine
Don,
that.
Sure, Don was in. He played an agent, the Hollywood agent.
How was he to work with? You directed as well, didn't
no.
you? No. That one?
I came in and worked it with George Kaufman and his wife. And I didn't direct it. George was not well, and Cy Pure stepped in and directed, but we all kind of did it together. And it's a good show.
Well, I'd like to hear Alexander Graham Bell.
Yeah, he's a good singer, Don is.
What's his role in Silk Stockings?
He plays an agent, the Hollywood agent. And he's got a song, I don't know which song you've chosen.
Silk Stockings.
Yeah, because he also had a song, I love the looks of you. I would want to take 10% of you. You know, he was an agent, Hollywood agent, who falls in love with this Russian, with Ninotchka.
Well, here's a touch of Silk Stockings in the Night.
Silk stockings, I touch them and find the joys that remind me of you. Silk stockings that give me again your shy laughter when they were new. Silk stockings, what days they recall, when love promised all forevermore. A pair of silk stockings, so soft and so sheer, the dear silk stockings. Oh, oh,
this is WGN Clear Channel Radio from Chicago. Tonight, Abe Burrows, and what a delight. And another hour of that delight to go. A little bit later on, we're going to take your telephone calls. The lines are open right now, if you don't mind getting in line and waiting for just a bit. The number is as usual. And we're going to, we'll say the number, 591-7200. 591-7200. We'll take a quick pause, and then right back to Abe Burrows. And I think I want to talk when we come back about the Hollywood scene and about those many Hollywood personages who figure in your book, Honest Abe. And did I mention that Honest, Abe is published by Atlantic Little Brown? Right back after this. Thank you very much, George Bauer. My guest...
I wanted to just say one thing. Could I...
Wait, I've got
to
reintroduce you.
I'm sorry.
I got to reintroduce you.
Oh, yeah.
You may not remember, but you are Abe Burrows, playwright, producer, play doctor, author, librettist, autobiographer, and graduate of New Utrecht High School in Brooklyn.
Oh, yes, yes.
Now, what did you want to
say? No, it just hit me when I heard the initials WGN, because when I was a kid in the Bronx, we had a radio set. A Majestic or something it was, and I used to play with it. And one night my parents were out, and I got up late. There was no interference. And I turned out I get WGN in Chicago. I couldn't wait till the morning. I ran up and down the block. I was a hero. I got WJN.
Do you remember what the program was?
No, I just know WGN. I just went crazy.
Well, in those days we were, as we are to this very moment, one of the, I think, 18 clear channel stations in the country. Nobody else is on the same frequency.
Amazing.
And at night with the atmospheric changes,
it was just a thrill.
It
was such a thrill.
Gee, I'd love to...
I felt like Marconi.
Well, I'd love to show off for you and get a really long-distance call tonight. We get them from all over the place. We've had them from New York. We've had them from Texas and as far out west as Denver and so on, as far north as Saskatchewan. So if you're out there, we've still got one line that isn't filled, and we welcome a long-distance call. We'll put it on first if and when we get it. The area code is 312, and then the magic number is 591 and 7200. On to Hollywood.
Yes.
We'll get on to the phones in about 10 minutes, but I've got to get... more of this material that is so beautifully developed in your book. The Hollywood scene in the days that you were there and the personages that you dealt with, a number of interesting people show up here. I love what you have to say and the representation you give of Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah, he was a good friend. I was in awe of him, and I got to know him. I got to know him. It was a party, and I sang some of those songs which you've had on the air here.
And he sang them with you.
He learned them, and later on he knew all the lyrics and everything. He was an amazing man. First of all, most people don't know he was a beautiful man, by the way, physically. He was a very handsome man. You know, always that little guy with the mustache and all that stuff. But he was handsome, not very tall, but a very handsome man, and he used to encourage me a lot and made me feel good.
The Imperial L.B. Mayer comes through in your book as not quite as odious as he is when represented by Norman Mailer in the novel The Deer Park, but still not exactly everybody's cuddly uncle.
Well, he was L.B., you know. I got a couple of stories about L.B. about that. I was at his house for a party and stuff like that. One day we were at a big party that Nunnally Johnson was giving, and I was dancing with my wife, and suddenly Mayer is dancing by me, and he hits me on the shoulder. And he says, "Abe, I'm glad I found you. You call my secretary tomorrow and tell her that you're to be invited to my house New Year's Eve." You know? So I said, well, be like... And
it is much to your credit that you did not make the call.
I didn't make that. But another party... His secretary called me once and says, "You're invited." And she said, "The ladies are wearing long dresses, but you may wear a business suit." And I said, "Tell Mr. Mayer, I'll try to get a business suit by Saturday." You know,
you know, somebody who comes through in your book in a way that pleases me a great deal, and he comes, though I didn't know much about him, it seems totally authentic. He seems to have just the sort of character that I always attributed to him, is Fred Allen, a man that I much admire.
He was a good friend. He was really a remarkable good friend and a remarkable guy. You know, I remember he was a fellow who gave dollars to the bums who hung, I shouldn't say bums, vagrants, out-of-work vagrants, or bums.
Right.
But I used to go watch his show. We were friends then.
Did you do some writing for him at any point?
No. We went when he did a guest star in Duffy's Tavern. When he was guest star, I wrote it for him, and I was very nervous. And when we finished the first reading, he said to Ed Gardner, "Well, what do we do now? Kick hell out of Abe, you know?" See, but it was like that. But this business of giving dollars, I once went to his show a couple of times. I used to go, but I walked out after Fred walked out, and I followed him with my wife, and a bum came over to me and said, hello, Mr. Allen. And I was told later, I gave the guy a buck, and Fred, people just came up and were told, the bums knew that if you say, hello, Mr. Allen, you got a buck. He just picked on me. He didn't know who
Allen
was. Allen
will do,
yeah.
I see. Yeah.
And then there was the guy, he used to give $5 on the stairs of St. Patrick's Cathedral every Sunday. And one day, the guy disappeared. I guess he died. Fred kept asking, where is he, you know? He was a remarkable man and a dear man.
Something about him that comes through and poses a sort of contrast between Allen and most of the showbiz people one hears about, or even the occasional ones that you meet, is that he seems to have been rather introspective, withdrawn, living a quiet life.
Oh, in the little apartment.
Not a tumbler at all.
Little apartment. Yeah. He didn't own a car. When in Hollywood, he used to come visit me. He walked from his hotel and carrying a bottle of scotch as a gift, and he was very
sort of
modest.
A quality of modesty. I was
very
about to use
modest.
The same word.
He was a New Englander, you know. And
That was one of the great comic inventions. Not only, all of Allen was superb, but Allen's Alley and those types. When you mention New Englander, I think of Titus Moody, who was one of his stock characters
and
on Allen's Alley.
Mrs. Nussbaum.
Mrs. Nussbaum and Senator Claghorn.
And Fred, you know, he had writers. You know, that a lot of people don't know that one of his writers, his comic writers, was Herman Wouk.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I mention it in the book, and Herman was a very funny writer of jokes, and then he suddenly became a very successful, serious writer. And it's very rare that a guy does that, but Herman's a beautiful
guy. It would be interesting to examine who the gag writers, the comedy writers were when you broke in, and what's happened to them since.
Oh, I don't know.
A lot of them have gone on to other things, haven't they?
A lot of them have gone on to their reward, you know.
Well, that too.
You know.
Yeah. You got a wonderful line from Damon Runyon that you quote in there about people dying. Do you remember it?
Yeah. He was standing in front of Lindy's, and some guy he knew died, and he said, they're hitting all around us. Isn't that a marvelous
that's
thing?
Superb. And you write about that in a section where you're talking about comedy as sort of a sustaining resource which, in a way, protects you from all the injuries of fate.
Many times I've said a joke is something that sometimes to keep from killing yourself. It's just your approach. Some guys would cry. I generally make a joke in a spot like that. And a joke is can be a very profound thing. George Kaufman once said about dying. He said, there comes an age when your friends start to die. And that's a very ironic,
not for you to die, but your friends start.
Isn't that?
Yeah. Last question before we get to the phones. And in a way, what we've just been saying leads up to it. What's funny? Do you have a theory of the nature of humor?
I have spoken to psychologists about this, philosophers and everything. One guy at Southern California said to me, I told him about how a joke works and everything, I think. And he said to me, and I said, they laugh. He says, why don't they cry? I had no answer for that. Because laughter is such a thing. You know, you can be assassinated when you're laughing. You're helpless. And something happens there, and nobody has yet said it. Something triggers it, and they laugh. And it has nothing to do with the audience. I have played in Washington, for instance, where you have audiences from all over the country. And in a few minutes, if you got a good thing going right, they all join and laugh at the same thing. And I look at them, and you wonder why.
Well, we've got a number of different theories around as to what the ultimate, the intrinsic nature of humor is, what's really funny. And one such theoretic line goes, essentially, virtually all humor is aggressive. It is disguised or sublimated or displaced aggressive statement, indirect aggressive statement.
Or it's also a covering of hurt. It isn't just aggressive. I know in Freud's book, you know, Jim Strachey has a book of Freud's jokes and everything, and a lot of it is to cover pain, you know, not just aggressive, the pain, you know.
Let's analyze one funny story and see how it works. What's a good funny story that comes to your mind?
Well, good funny story. There's a beauty of a thing I use periodically. It's in my book too. A fella goes in and he wants to find something to eat. He's in a bad neighborhood and there's a terrible restaurant, but he goes and sits down, He's very hungry, and he says he figures soup will be the safest thing. Mm-hmm. So he sits down, and he asks for a bowl of soup, and the bowl of soup goes. And a few months later, the waiter says, sir, he said he's not eating. The guy's not eating. And he says, sir, is there something wrong with the soup? He says, I just wish I hadn't stirred it.
Now, how does that work? That is funny. How does it work?
Well, it's a way of saying the soup is terrible, and yet you laugh at it. Now, I don't know exactly why you laugh at it, but you do.
I got another restaurant story for you.
Go ahead.
This is at the Stage Delicatessen, and three guys come in. They're all friends of yours, and they sit down, and the waiter comes over and says, what will it be, gentlemen? And the first guy says, for me, Max, just a glass of tea. The second one says, for me also, Max, a glass tea. And the third one says, I'll also have a glass tea, Max, but it should be in a clean glass. And the waiter comes back after 5 minutes with three glasses of tea, and he says, which one was the clean glass? How does that work?
I don't know.
You find that funny?
Go. How can you break it down? It's very hard to break it down. I have given up. I know I've heard people just... Freud talked about aggression, you know, and a lot of the Jewish jokes are from pain, you know. But at the same time, I'm still not certain. All I know is that I think funny. A funny thing comes out of it and I guess it's to keep from crying sometimes. Really.
Jewish jokes, of course, go in a certain direction. One of them is kind of hair-splitting logic, which... somehow confounds the stream of events. My favorite along those lines, I bet you know the story, the old man and woman in bed late at night, and she wakes up and nudges her husband and says, Chaim, get up and close the window, it's cold outside. And he says, don't bother me. She says, get up and close the window, it's cold outside. Finally, he stumbles to the window, closes it, falls back in bed, snores once, opens one eye and says, so, I closed the window. Now it's warm outside.
Yeah, well, that's wonderful. It's a very logical thing, but the way you say, of course, I like the one of the rabbi, the philosophy, his philosophy, who said, the best thing that could happen is to not be it. Born at all. But unfortunately, this happens to very few. Now, again, it's talking of the pain of the big universe and putting it into a joke.
I think that was said by the rabbi of Chelm, as played by Zvira Mostel, probably, don't you think?
There's a famous story about...
Shalom Aleichem lived on your block. I just mentioned Chelm.
When I was a kid, I didn't know it.
Yeah.
I knew it was a big man. I had never heard of him. I was 6 years old, and his funeral... whole block was crowded, and I didn't appreciate him until much later. There's one story that's Karen and I kind of live by periodically, my wife and Karen, about Noah's Ark, the story of Noah's Ark. When all the animals came on Noah's Ark, the giraffes, the lions, everybody, they were told not to mate. There wasn't any more room on the
We'll have no hanky-panky on board.
No hanky-panky. So when finally they landed on Mount Ararat, they came off two by two. The two giraffes, the two lions, whatever they were. Then came the cats, two cats. And they came down, followed by a whole litter of kittens. And as the tomcat passed Noah, he looked up and he said, you thought we were fighting, didn't you?
An excellent moment, or a necessary moment for a pause, at any rate. And then we're going to get on to the telephones. The number 591-7200, 312, the area code if you're calling long distance. Thank you very much, George Bauer. A. Burroughs, having committed a fugue a long time ago, has now committed an autobiography. The name of it is Honest Abe. Subtitle, Is There Really No Business Like Show Business? It's a wonderful book, and it's just published by Atlantic Little Brown. Our phone number is 591-7200, 591-7200, and it's time to turn to your public, Abe. Good evening. You're on the air.
I want to talk to you, Abe, and to Miller. I've been sitting here listening to this phone and just absolutely cracking up. Does Abe remember in the days when he did, what was the thing, I'll take your word?
We take your word.
We take your word.
That's the derivation of word. That's the only time
you I... You are the only one I ever met in my life who knew the... Do you still remember the definition of a skinker?
Of a stinker?
S-K-I-N-K-E-R.
S-K-I-T.
S-K-I-N-K-E-R.
Yeah, a skinker.
What is it? I don't know it.
It's one who works for a living.
A skinker?
Yes.
I like that.
You told me.
Yeah, I remember vaguely now.
That was, I was a graduate student at Case Institute of Technology, and my wife and some friends of I used to listen to you and that group, and it just wiped us out.
Yeah, well, I remember I did it with Dr. Lyman Bryson, who was a teacher,
yes,
a professor
right.
at Columbia, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I used to have, I'm fascinated with that whole subject.
Well, the subject is etymology.
Etymology.
And among your many other achievements, you are an etymologist.
Yeah, and also the word etymology. A lot of people come over to me and say, Abe, you're good
That's
at
bugs.
What? Entomology, people say to me. They
bugs.
Say entomology. And they say, what is it? Entomology, etymology. I said, forget it. If you don't know, don't ask me.
That's right.
Nice to hear from you, sir.
You have given us so much pleasure, and Milt, you have too.
Thank you, sir. It's very kind of you to
I'm having
here.
A great time with Milt. I really am.
I'd like to meet him someday, and I would like to meet you, and there's no way we ever shall.
Well, you can meet Milt. You live in Chicago?
No, I live in the northwest suburbs.
Oh.
Well, we're around. Give us a call, and maybe we can invite
Milton
you over for a program
anything. Yeah.
Why, sure.
I'm not sure whether I would accept or not.
Yeah.
Well, it's very nice having heard
You've
from you.
You've given us a lot of pleasure tonight.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Good night for now. 591-7200 is our number. 591-7200. Some lines are open now if you've been trying to get through and haven't made it. And here is the next caller. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
This is quite a coincidence because my question is also regarding We Take Your Word. We used to have many hours of enjoyment listening to that show. My mother and I used to just love it. And, you know, Lyman Bryson was the only other panel name I could remember. Who else was on that? Was it a woman I know?
Well, we used to have a woman guest every week.
Oh.
We had our moderator was McCaffrey.
John McCaffrey.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
Yes. I'm glad you listened. I miss that show.
I miss that show and all others of its kind. It seems as if we can't have small shows such as that anymore.
Well, that's interesting, ma'am. What were others of its kind? What else do you remember and miss?
The good word games, even in the early days of TV, for instance, the Bergen Evans panel show. Also, it pays to be ignorant. Things like that. Little things that we used to get great enjoyment out of. Along the word line, though, that if that's what you mean, the only one that comes to my mind is the Bergen Evans TV show.
I did Bergen Evans show a couple of times, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And but they were just shows that made you think.
What do you like on radio now?
You?
Well, apart from that.
apart from that, I listen to, I kind of go amongst a couple of different stations. I like the talk shows, but I don't find too many that I really listen to. On other stations, I really enjoy listening to Sherman Kaplan's interview.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's very intelligent. As a matter of fact, I was just talking about him with my husband the other day. I said, you know, he's like, no, we really enjoy his interviews.
Well, he's an interesting guide to Chicago's restaurants as well.
Oh, yes, we enjoy that a lot. And we use his books, too. That's right, yeah. So things along that line are the things that we enjoy. And I listen to the radio, I think, more in the evening than the TV, really.
Well, we're very glad that you're listening tonight, and thank you for calling, ma'am.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you.
Our number, 591-7200, 591-7200. Another caller, good evening, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm Jim from Oak Lawn, and I just wanted to talk to Abe. I was in Guys and Dolls over the summer at 99th Street Summer Theater, and I had the part of Nicely Nicely Johnson. That was one of my, I tell you, it's probably maybe because I worked with it a lot, but my favorite song in that whole play was Sit On Your Rock and Roll.
Oh, yeah, that was great. Great song.
This relates to a point that you were making to me, Abe, while we were off the air during some commercials about why this thing is played all over still.
Yeah, because there's not an off-color line in the whole show. And kids play it. I have a niece who at the age of 12 played Nathan Detroit.
Really.
Oh, yeah. We have the guy that played our Sky Masterson had the also part of Nathan Detroit in another play.
Yeah.
It was an unbelievable part. The people in our play, it just... Like, there was another show going on at the same time, Anything Goes. and we were like working together. We practiced on the same nights. And I know we always had the people from Anything Goes in watching our rehearsals, because the show, it just had so many great lines in it and songs.
Yeah. Well, Nicely Nicely was a great part.
It was weird, because the guy that originally had played it was just came out of from another show you wrote, How to Succeed in Business.
Yeah.
And which I'm going to be trying out for over the summer in the same you know, organization. But it was really great. I liked, if you can, I don't know if you know from that WFMT said they gave you some records for it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have that song?
We don't have it here right now. I'm sorry.
Oh, I just wanted to say that it was probably, I've been in 6 plays, and that was one of the best plays I've ever been in.
Well, thank you.
It was really good.
Thank you. And I'm glad you played Rock in the Boat. That was a great song.
Yeah, we they did it with the chorus, and we had them swaying back and forth. It was really neat.
Well, you must be a good singer.
It was a good time.
How old are you now?
I'm 16. I go to Marist.
Well, you're 16, and you already did a big-time show. Goodness.
You know, Nick, can I ask you? I'll tell you. For the future, what advice would you give? Like, say, you know, I love musicals, you know, and I've been in them, and I'm, you know, I like to sing a lot. What advice would you give for going into a college?
To what?
What advice would you like for going into that kind of a field?
Well, it's a very tough field, but if you got patience and you can find some way to eat, you know, you know, that's the problem. But if you're good, if you want to push at it, you know, some people come up to go to New York and fall into it right away.
Yeah, the kid that I was in the play with now, have you ever heard of Tony Bill?
Who?
Tony Bill.
Tony Galt?
Tony Bill. Tony B-I-L-L.
Tony Bill. Oh, yeah.
They just did a show in Chicago, and the guy that was my partner, the guy that played Benny, he had a role in a show that they just filmed in Chicago, My Bodyguard, and he just went to Hollywood.
Yeah?
To live with Tony Bill, and it's really neat.
I think maybe you're going to have a career in theater.
Yeah.
I hope so.
You sound like you've got the ambition.
You got moxie.
Thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
Good night.
Bye.
Our number is 591-7200. We'll be back to the phone shortly. 591-7200.
I wonder if you knew what moxie was, you know?
I don't think the word... Well, it's an etymological question.
Now it became a thing, because moxie was a drink, which has disappeared.
In Boston, originally.
But it used to be a sign on a signboard, you say, you got moxie, you get moxie. Moxie was a strong thing.
There's something about your presence that makes me think of Jewish stories, and this relates as well to what the young caller was just saying to us, asking for some advice. You know the great story about the man from out of New York who is looking for Carnegie Hall, where he's got some tickets, but he gets lost in New York, and he's wandering on the Lower East Side, where you were born, and stops a little old Jewish gentleman and asks him, say, how do I get to Carnegie Hall? Do you remember the answer?
Practice.
And that's
so
your advice to this fellow.
Sure.
591-7200, that's our number. This is WGN, Clear Channel Radio from Chicago. I'm talking tonight with Abe Burrows, whose new autobiography is titled Honest Abe, and we'll be right back after this. Thank you very much, George Bauer. Our number is 591-7200. Some lines are open for your calls, and here is the next caller. Good evening.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Abe?
Yeah.
Listen, Abe, didn't you do a program on, I don't know if it was radio, I guess, was Can You Top This, or with George S. Kaufman?
It was called This is Show Business.
Oh, okay.
No, he's asking about the program, Can You Top This One?
Oh,
I remember the program.
No, I wasn't in that.
Weren't you on that one?
No.
All right. Another question I want to ask, Abe, was that when you have a play like Guys and Dolls and they cast it, and I know I'm kind of an amateur writer myself, does it bother you when it comes to casting? I mean, are you always 100% satisfied, or do you have the say-so in casting?
Well, you mean, are we satisfied with our cast?
Well, I know you're satisfied. I don't want to put you on a spot. I know you're always satisfied with your cast, especially if you do the casting yourself. But, I mean, for instance, when you see your play come to the movies, and you'll see, now, I'll give an example, and you don't have to put yourself on a spot. For instance, Sam Levine played Nathan Detroit.
Yeah.
And I know there was a lot of people were disappointed that he didn't get the part in the movie, but because he wasn't that well known.
I was disappointed when he didn't get the part, too.
Yeah.
Even though it was Frank Sinatra.
Yeah, I wanted Frank Sinatra to play what Brenda was doing.
Right. Exactly.
See, that's the point. Sinatra would have been great in that part.
Exactly.
And we need, well, Ilya Kazan, Gach Kazan, one of my close friends and a great director, called me after he saw the preview of that picture. And he called me in New York. He was in California. And he said, I just saw the screening of Guys and Dolls. And I said, how'd you like it? He says, I missed Levine. That's exactly it. So you hit it on the nose. They cast differently in movies. They don't cast only for acting.
They cast for box
name,
office. Yeah.
Name. That's right.
You can just imagine the conference in whoever's office it was.
That's right.
To guarantee this film, we've got to get somebody like Brando in,
that's
and
right.
then we've got real
and
box
Brando's
office.
And Brando's a great actor. It just wasn't right. This wasn't right for him.
But how about having the play come back again as a TV special? Can you imagine having Sinatra as a Sky Master.
Oh, I'd love that.
As Nathan Detroit.
I'd love that.
John
love
Rickles
it.
Is Nicely Johnson.
Someday we'll do that. Yeah, well, I'm glad you called.
Okay, thank you, Ed.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you for
Bye.
The call, sir.
You're welcome.
Our number, 591-7200.
They're all so friendly out there.
They are friendly. Well, this is a friendly town. You're the sort of guy who kind of brings
I
out
played, yeah,
friendly
I played.
Reactions.
Don't forget, I played the Mayfair Room of the Blackstone in 1948.
Doing your songs.
My nightclub, I did a whole nightclub tour, about a year and a half.
But that was in the days when you were doing the satirical songs and
yeah.
the funny patter that went
and
along
talk,
with them.
Yeah, talking, I was good looking then.
you grew accustomed to baldness early in life, you say that in
yeah,
the book.
Yeah, I
never felt
were,
bald because you always
never,
were bald.
Never, because I think all my hair was gone, not all of it, I mean I have some side, but when I was about 24, 25. My son Jimmy, who's a director in Hollywood, also follows the thing. He's directing a show called Taxi, and he's very good.
Which one is that?
Taxi is the television show.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
He's
Jimmy's
the director,
director
of it. I see. What's this business about your being the play doctor? How many plays have you doctored? And what
I would
it
say
mean
about
to doctor a play.
About I've done about 19 shows, and about 4 of them were doctoring. When I first went in and fixed a show, right after Guys and Dolls, there was a show based on a Molnar play called Make-A-Wish, and it was falling apart. The author had left and everything. So I came in, and I said, keep it secret. I'm going to work on it. I'll help you out. Well, a week later, in the New York Times, was a great big article, said, Mr. Fix-It. And from then on, every time I showed up, they thought I'm going to fix something.
What do you do when you fix a play?
You don't. Really.
You can't
tell
you.
I think of all of them, one show I doctored out about 4 that really was a hit was What Makes Sammy Run with Steve Lawrence, and he was great. And that one, I took over the director in that show, and I worked on, with the authors, and I really fixed it. It was a big hit.
Well, who was the original author? Did Schulberg do his own?
No, Schulberg was big. But they had it. I replaced the director.
Oh,
who evidently wasn't helping them enough, and I did, and I went and pitched in with them. Bud Schulberg is a good friend of mine. So that worked. But otherwise, the best I could do with some shows is to keep from getting hit with sticks. In other words, not embarrassing. One show that Make-A-Wish, which ran a while, and they thanked me. They sent me a letter of thanks, said, at least we weren't embarrassed, that's all.
Our number, 591-7200, and we ought to get back to the phones. Here's a long-distance call. Where are you calling from, please?
Peoria, Illinois.
Yes, sir.
I would like to talk to Mr. Burroughs on Most Happy Fellow with Frank Lesser.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was in the stage production here in Peoria, Illinois in 1959 playing Chichio.
Ah.
And that was my first production and my first musical. And I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I think Mr. Lesser was one of the great ones.
Oh, he was. He died too soon. He really did. I miss him very much. That was close to an opera, a real opera.
Yes, we thought so. And
it had about 35 songs in little, big songs.
There's a wonderful song in it that you didn't mention before.
What's
but I know
that?
You love Standing on the Corner,
watching
all the girls go by.
Oh. And my heart is so full of you.
Oh, that's one of my favorites.
Isn't that a beautiful one?
And Mama, Mama.
Yeah.
The whole show is just great, and I know we just lost a great musician, and
yes,
I enjoyed all of his other shows.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear you say
Did
that.
He ever have aspirations to write it in the symphonic framework or so-called serial
He
music?
Was going on and on. His brother, you see, Frank's brother was the famous... late Arthur Lesser, who was a pianist and who wrote a book on the piano, and Art Rubinstein, all the players, piano players, stopped off at his home. He lived in Cleveland, and he was a great genius. So Frank came from that kind of family.
Well, sir, we thank you for the call.
Well, thank you very much, and best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye.
Good night. There's an interesting anecdote in your book about you and Artur Rubinstein.
Yeah.
Rubinstein watches you play the piano.
Well, I was Larry Adler's home in Beverly Hills, and I was playing the piano and my songs. And when I came off, got up, Rubinstein said to me, "You know, I envy you." He says, "You play with such joy. I attack it. I attack it, you know, like it's work. But I was doing it. I do it. I have fun." One time at Groucho Marx's, a party, and I'm sitting at the piano, and suddenly, in walks Iturbe. I'd never met him.
Jose Iturbe.
Jose Iturbe, and Groucho takes him over to the piano, and I stop playing, you know, and he says, "Don't stop, Abe. Mr. Iturbe to hear you." So I, with my own, see, I taught myself to play. And I'm,
well, you had one or two lessons, four,
I
guess.
But I hated the teacher. Yeah. Anyway, I taught, and I'm playing, and Iturbe looks, and he said, "Impossible," and walked away.
Now, I noted that story in the book, but it remains ambiguous. What did he mean? Did he mean it's impossible to play that way,
yeah,
or did he mean it's impossible to listen to?
He wasn't very friendly either. He just said impossible and walked away. He's out. You know, Groucho must have kidded and said he's a great pianist. You know what I mean? That kind of thing.
Let's get back to the phones. Here's another long-distance call. Where are you calling from, please?
I'm calling from Menominee Falls, Wisconsin.
Very good. Go ahead, ma'am.
I was listening to your trying to define humor, and the humor that I always use or that really cracks me up is things that are absurd. You know, the ridiculousness of things.
Give us an example.
Well, you gave one of the man saying, "So now it's warm outside,
right,
close
yeah.
the window." That's absolutely, it just cracks me up. I think that is so funny. That's the kind of humor I appreciate.
Yeah, well, it's funny. Everybody got the kind they look. For instance, a lot of the kids today are making jokes that are kind of grim, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But they have audiences, you know.
Well, I made one up for the girls one day, and we were talking about places to live, and I said, "You know, I always wanted to live in a subdivision called Manic Heights." And they just cracked up, and I thought, "Yeah, that's
yeah.
kind of funny."
Yeah.
Well, I want to tell you something interesting about that from the realm of contemporary psychology. It turns out, on the basis of research studies, that different kinds of personality types find different sorts of humor funny.
Yeah.
And in recent years, a few people, one of them an old colleague of mine from back in New Haven, named Jack Levine, he's one of a number of people who've been working up diagnostic tests based upon humor. The tests really present various jokes, sometimes in cartoon form, sometimes mm-hmm. in printed form, and they will often provide three or four different punchlines on a multiple choice basis and ask you to choose the one that you think is the funniest, and thereby they get some basis for a diagnostic judgment of the person.
Well, I hope they're not going to come and drag me off to the home, but
yeah.
so much.
Well, you see, now you made a joke just then. It's a very good joke, and you're a funny lady. I don't mean funny looking, I can't see you. But you're a funny lady, I could tell. You got a good sense of humor, and I think it adds years to everybody's life.
I think so, too. You have given me a lot of pleasure.
Thank you very much.
And I'm glad to have this opportunity to talk to you.
Thank you.
Take care.
Good night, ma'am. On to another caller. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, hi. Ed Burroughs. I wanted to know, do you get the credit for, I've got tears in my ears.
Tears in my ears?
Because I'm lying on my bed crying over you.
No, but I'm going to get credit for it from now on. I'm going to say it.
I thought that was yours.
I'll say I made it up.
No, I thought that was yours a long time ago.
No, a lot of songs are attributed to me, like Fred Allen once said on his program, he was quoting me, but he had made up the joke. He says, "If I had my life to live over again, I'd live it over a delicatessen." But it was Fred Allen. He said, "Hey,
you've made a very funny joke before, but you didn't mean to."
Yeah.
About the man who wrote a book on the piano.
Oh, yeah.
I thought that was funny.
Yeah, but he wrote a book called About the Piano, the whole life of a piano from the time it was invented.
I know, but you said he wrote the book on the piano.
Yeah, well, he probably did.
Okay. Milt, may I ask you one question?
Sure.
I don't know really how old you are, but Do you remember 30, the Utrecht Theater?
39.
At the Hollywood Theater?
Say it again.
Hollywood Theater on New Utrecht Avenue.
New Utrecht Avenue.
Good heavens. Are you a Bensonhurst girl, too?
Am I not? Bensonhurst,
oh,
Flatwood,
wow.
Bay Ridge, Long Island.
Well, how lovely.
But you see, you know you've lost your good accent.
You're kidding. Not according to the people that I work with.
Well, but did you live in... when did you live in Bensonhurst?
Oh, that was like 40s.
Well, now, indulge us. Tell us exactly where you lived in Bensonhurst.
Okay. I lived... Well, I don't... Was this considered Bensonhurst? 77th Street and 13th Avenue.
No, I think that... Well, that's into Bay Ridge, I think.
Yeah.
Into Bay Ridge,
yeah.
Okay. Close. Then in Bay Ridge.
In between Borough Park and Bay Ridge.
Okay, I was right in the middle.
It
right.
Really is nowhere.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I kind of... but do you remember the Flatbush Theater when they used to have shows on Saturday afternoon?
Sure,
all the big bands?
Sure.
Well, that was in the downtown section of Brooklyn,
yeah.
Wasn't it?
That was Church and Flatbush Avenue.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, how lovely.
So,
I think we ought to organize a Brooklyn Expatriates Club in Chicago.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
I'm all for
I wrote
it.
A song once. I want to go back there to my home there in Brooklyn, USA. There, back to the whence I first came from. I had such a song.
Fantastic. Hey, it's great talking to you. I enjoy it. Nope, I enjoy your program so
Thank
much.
Thank you.
They well, could burn up all the television stations and... You could just stay on the air all night.
Well, thank you very
I love
much.
It.
That's very kind.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
591-7200. That's our number. Our guest, Abe Burrows, and we'll be right back to the phones after this. Can you find something humorous and reassuring about any of the things that burden us these days when it comes to bad news?
It's very hard. It used to be. No, it's pretty hard. It's. I don't make political jokes now.
You can make jokes out of inflation, but you really can't make them out of Afghanistan or Cambodia.
And and even inflation now that's stopped. You talk about high prices and stuff like that. It's painful now. No, I don't want to give pain.
No. Back to the telephones. Here is the next caller. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening. You mentioned Bergen Evans. Is that Dr. Evans from Northwestern University you're referring to?
Yeah, he was.
Abe, I had a friend of mine, Tony Gilman, that appeared with him on television here many years ago. Do you remember her?
What's the name again?
Tony Gilman.
Tony Gilman.
She appeared with Dr. Evans on this program from appeared with Northwestern University. And Down You Go, I think they called her, something like that.
Yeah, I remember being on a show, and I think I met a lady when he was doing his show.
I was just wondering if you remembered her and whatever happened to her. She was in Chicago, and she appeared in many theaters, and she was with Dr. Evans.
No, I don't know.
No, I guess we can't help you on that one, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. It's all right.
All right. Thank
all right.
You for the
Thanks
call.
For call. That program, I remember I got into a big fight with John Mason Brown, who was on the panel with me. And
he was
and
a theater reviewer for the
very,
Old Herald Tribune.
Yeah, very
right?
bright man and everything. But he would not agree that go slow. For instance, the sign says go slow. And slow is an adverb. Just he said it had to be slowly, and he hated all the signs that said go slow.
He was right.
Slow is an adverb. Look in any dictionary, in my Oxford.
All right. I'm adaptable. He was wrong.
You got to give up. No, it really is an adverb. Go slow. It's not incorrect. I may save the lives of a lot of people.
Well, and you've saved me from verbal embarrassments. I tend to say go
slowly. Slowly is correct, too, but some people think slowly is a nice Nellyism.
On to another caller, 591-7200. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Milt, I wanted to ask Abe about a show. It was a musical show that he did. It lasted about 15 minutes. It was on a CBS many years ago, 34 years ago, I guess it was an accordionist, Milt DeLug.
Milton DeLug was my accompanist, sure.
And you used to sing all kinds of crazy songs of your own.
That's right.
Of your own design.
That.
And I remember one, For Every Man There's a Woman, So How Did I Get Stuck With You?
Yeah, I did a little bit. Yeah, For Every Man There's a Woman, So How Come I Wound Up With You?
but I'm curious to know, what was the name of that show?
The name was The Abe Burrows Show.
Wow, how logical.
No, it wasn't. And it wasn't 15 minutes. It was a half
no,
hour.
No, first
show,
it was 15 minutes.
Oh,
he's
I remember
quite right.
It was a half hour.
Then I did a half hour later. But
well, how long did that thing last?
I did it for about a year, and then I went to New York, and I The CBS wanted me to do a situation thing, and I did a show called Breakfast with Burroughs. He gets up late. It was 9 o'clock at night.
What I'm curious about is, are there recordings of that material around that anybody
could buy? Well, sure, sir. I think you must have missed the beginning of the program tonight, did you?
Yes, I did.
Because we played some of it. Though, of course, we got it, as I said earlier, through the good auspices of WFMT from the record library. Are those old records still in print? So
they're out of print. They become collector's items, and I'm not one of the collectors, you know.
Oh, they ought to be reissued.
Yeah. Well, I'm gonna.
Because I can assure you, I would buy them.
I may do another one.
You cut a new one.
And enjoyed your show immensely. And Abe, I have to tell you that I've been one of your biggest fans for many years.
Well, gee, thanks very much.
Thanks a lot.
It's good to hear from you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the call, sir. Good night. Listen, we've just got about 3 minutes left, and I want to turn serious. Not ponderous, but merely serious. You are a man I much admire, and this book of yours, which I've enjoyed tremendously, only further reinforces my admiration for you, the pleasure I take in you. I think you've lived a good life. Undoubtedly, it's had some of hard moments. Lives do. I don't ask this sort of question of most people. I ask it of the wise elder gentleman, if you'll allow me to classify you as that, though you're vigorous and young.
I can't stop you.
But you're approaching 70,
yeah,
so you've lived
that's
a rather
right.
lengthy life by now, and I trust it will go on forever. Oh, King, live forever. Still, in almost 70 years, what have you learned about human existence?
I would say darn near nothing.
That's a very honest answer.
Yeah, it's an honest one. I know it. I like being a member of the human race. I know people. The human... my wife is an anthropologist. She's... and we talk about it many times, the development of man. And I don't know if he's improved much through the years in terms of wisdom. Knowledge, yes. There's a big difference between knowledge and wisdom. And I think wisdom has not changed. In other words, when you ask about the wisest men in the world, they were guys way back 2,000 years ago, more. And after all the great discoveries, but, you know, they talk about Columbus saying the world is round, where the Greeks knew it was round way back in 2,000 years ago or so. And there was a fellow who actually measured the circumference of the globe, a Greek scientist. So that hasn't improved. I don't think the character of human beings, their desires and everything has not changed. So it's not. I'm not depressed about it. I'm just knowing as a fact.
You can live with it. You've been living with it for a long time.
I haven't got a choice.
That's right.
You know, and if you accept that, I like people. I like people. I like the people who call just now. You know, take the trouble to call, not because they just like me, but it was friendly. They wanted to know things and take. And the one thing that must always go on is communication in the whole world. The communication overseas, communication with different nations and everything. And people want to communicate. They call here, they like you, and they call, and they want to touch. And I felt that.
I felt it too tonight, and it's been a great boon having you here. I've enjoyed this program as much as any I've ever done. Abe Burrows' new autobiography, titled Honest, Abe, Honest Abe, is just published by Atlantic Little Brown. We are out of time. Thanks very much for coming, Abe.